Good evening. I'm very happy to be on your campus. I don't get over here much, and that's my fault. But hopefully you'll invite me back. This has a feel of Howard University. I gave a talk there several years ago on Noble Drew Ali, and it was a very similar looking audience. Very similar kind of vibe, so I'm excited to be here this evening. So I've been tasked with limiting my comments to 15 minutes and taking you from the antebellum period into the modern period with respect to the experience of African Muslims and their descendants. So let's see how we can do that. It seems to me that we've got to think about the context in which people of African descent found themselves toward the end of the 19th century into the beginning of the 20th century. It was a veritable existential crisis. That is to say, people had been uprooted from their homeland, out of West Africa, West Central Africa, also as well Southwestern, Southeastern Africa. And in addition, there were indeed some North Africans who were enslaved in this country. Not many, but they were there. And as they went through this experience of enslavement, the Muslim community certainly fought to maintain its traditions, to maintain its integrity. But it became very difficult, you know, more and more difficult as the decades passed. It became difficult to pass on literacy in Arabic. It was very difficult without sacred texts. One could not study hadith, one could not study sunnah, so forth. It was very difficult. In addition to that, large numbers of black people were beginning to embrace Christianity in varying forms. So you can imagine that there was a tremendous amount of pressure brought to bear on the Muslim community to convert, to change, to become like others. So there was a lot of pressure, a lot of difficulties involved. One of the things that I've tried to do in my own research is to see if, in fact, we could establish any kind of continuity from the period of slavery into the latter part of the 19th century. It's been very, very difficult to do that. There does seem to be some evidence, some suggestion that, in fact, there was a sensibility, some concept of the fact that there were these, Islamic antecedents, that is, that people did have Muslim forebears. There was some sense of that, in particular in the Low Country in Georgia, South Carolina, and in the Mississippi Basin. But it was very difficult to establish that in my own study and to establish direct links. But there were indications that, in fact, if not, Islam as a coherent practice was continuing. There was a continuing sense of having been, of this community having once existed, okay, in the South, and of having one's roots in Islam. There was a sensibility, it would appear, that will continue. You will recall that Lorenzo Turner was collecting information, gathering data, in the Georgia, South Carolina, Low Country in the 1930s. I invite you to go back and take a look at his work. In that work, he recovers a number of names and concepts which have direct linkages to Islam or to West African Muslim societies. So this is data that was being collected in the 1930s. Okay. As well, we do have indications of Muslims perhaps practicing as late as the 1920s in the same area. So there is some indication, qualify the term indication, that, you know, some sense of the religion was moving forward. But at toward the end of the 19th century into the beginning of the 20th century, the African American community was experiencing a real crisis because it wasn't clear whether they were, so they had been emancipated in a sense, but in another sense they were still very much second class, third class citizens in the land in which they were born. You know, they weren't quite Americans. They had been, there had been rupture from the African continent, and there was a lot of searching going on within the African American community, okay, for a sense of identity, for some answers as to precisely who they were and the meaning of their existence in this country. And it was in that context, okay, that we begin to see the development of certain movements which sought to respond, okay, to this crisis. There were any number of movements in the latter part of the 19th century into the 20th century that sought to respond to this challenge. Various Christian-based movements, Jewish-based movements. There were a number of organizations which emerged during this period in time which espoused Judaism. I'm talking about among black people. But there were also movements, organizations, which were Islamic-like. Okay, that is to say, they espoused some brand of Islam. There was some association with the notion of Islam. And one of the most important of those movements was the Moorish Science Temple, which was founded by an individual named Noble Drew Ali. Now, I'm going to be careful in my comments here because I see an array of people here, and I don't know what, you know, what affiliations people have and so forth. And this is, you know, this is highly charged territory, terrain upon which I'm about to tread. But Noble Drew Ali was born, as far as we know, in 1886, apparently someplace in North Carolina. The precise location is difficult to determine. And according to the lore of the Moorish Science Temple, Noble Drew Ali founded the Canaanite Temple in Newark in 1912 or 1913. And thus begins the movement known as Moorish Science. And what Noble Drew Ali taught was that black people were Canaanites, more specifically Moabites, okay, who moved from the Central Islamic lands to Northwest Africa, to the Maghreb, in particular Morocco, and that this was the true ancestry of black people. And that ancestry was connected to a number of other groups of people that whom Noble Drew Ali labeled as Asiatics. And he made the point that all of these individuals were in fact Muslim. So for Noble Drew Ali, he began to promote the notion or the idea that a group's identity, that is, corporate identity, was divinely determined, okay, and was unalterable. It could not change. What you were from the beginning is what you are now. This is what Noble Drew Ali taught. And that black people and other Asiatics, okay, were by nature Muslim and Moors. Now, it wasn't clear, and it is not clear, to what extent Noble Drew Ali had access to, you know, orthodox instruments of the religion of Islam. The first widely distributed translation into English of the Quran was in 1917 by a guy named Maulana Muhammad Ali. It is an Ahmadi text, which is something that I can talk about, but a little later. But that text was in operation. It was available in 1917. Interestingly, Noble Drew Ali pens something called the Circle 7 Quran in 1927, which bears no relationship to the Quran. But this becomes the, so he pins this text 10 years after the English translation is available. So that suggests that Noble Drew Ali had some intentionality about what he was trying to do. But the point I'm simply making here is that at a very early point in time, there was a fusion. There was a fusion, okay, between notions of corporate identity, Black nationalism, and religion, in particular, Islam. Okay, you follow me so far? That continues on in time, so that Noble Drew Ali dies in 1929 under very suspicious circumstances. There was a problem within the Moorish Science Temple. The organization had moved to Chicago in 1925. There was an internecine struggle in Chicago. A fellow named Sheikh Claude Green tried to take over the organization. He was assassinated. There were difficulties. Noble Drew Ali was arrested for the murder and died shortly after being released in prison. The speculation is that he was beaten in prison. Now, what's interesting also about Moorish Science, about the Moorish Science Temple, is that in addition to some of the teachings, they also began to establish their own businesses. And those businesses became relatively lucrative. They were very relatively lucrative businesses. Now, the reason I'm saying this is, and this is contested. But from what I can determine, there is a relationship between the pattern that is established on the Moorish Science Temple and the subsequent pattern developed with the Nation of Islam. Farad Muhammad appears on the scene in Detroit in 1930. He has a ready-made audience among Southerners who have trekked north to places like Detroit, and he begins to preach a message of self-acceptance and self-love among the Black community in that area. And it's around this time that we can date the beginning of the Nation of Islam. One of his early disciples was Elijah Poole, who is born in Georgia around 1897, probably in a place called Deep Step, Georgia. And he migrates to the area, becomes a convert to this religion. And this is the beginning phase, if you will, of the Nation of Islam. 1934, Farad Muhammad disappears. And between 1935 and 1946, we could refer to that as a kind of interregnum, because it's during this period in time in which there's a lot of flux in the Nation of Islam. The leadership is being contested. There's a lot of factionalism going on. There are competing organizations which emerge. Some of these organizations are tied into international have international implications and connections. In particular, a number of them are connected with Japanese nationalist organizations. So there's very interesting kinds of transnational networks being developed in the early part of the 20th century. By 1946, Elijah Muhammad has basically worked out the tenets of the Nation of Islam and has established the teachings. Now, he will say that all of the teachings come from Farad Muhammad. It is my belief that, in fact, that to a certain extent that is true, but to a large extent, Elijah Muhammad himself is the one who fashions many of the teachings. You're all familiar with those teachings. It's not necessary for me to go into them, but they do represent a kind of, they represent a divergence, if you will, from Sunni Islam. And in particular, there are some issues about the nature of Farad Muhammad and the role of Elijah Muhammad as a messenger, and how that relates to Orthodox teachings about the divine. Well, when Elijah Muhammad is coming out of prison, he goes into prison 1942, emerges 1946. He goes into prison because he refuses to enter the draft for World War II, and he comes out. This is a period of tremendous global consternation, if you will, because this is the period in which you're beginning to see the upswing of anti-colonial movements around the world, okay, middle of the 20th century. And this is important to keep in mind because I think it explains the phenomenon of Malcolm X very well, at least partially. Malcolm is born in Omaha, Nebraska, of all places, in 1925. He also goes to prison. It's in prison that he converts. And when he comes out of prison, he is able to actually meet Elijah Muhammad shortly thereafter. The Nation of Islam is, by that time, following the trajectory of the Moorish Science Temple in that it is also establishing businesses and so forth and, quote unquote, doing for self. But it's a relatively small organization. And there are all kinds of rival organizations out there. But it's with the conversion of Malcolm that we begin to see a substantial influx into the nation. And Malcolm is able to capture the times. And he is able to connect the teachings of the Nation of Islam with the struggle within the country for civil rights and human rights, and with the struggle in particular in Africa for independence. Now, as we know, toward the end of 1963, and I should say as well that the conversion of Muhammad Ali also has a very important impact with respect to raising the visibility of the Nation of Islam. Now, as we know, toward the end of 1963, in December of 1963, President Kennedy is assassinated. Malcolm says some things about it, which gets him into some hot water with the leadership, the Chicago-centered leadership of the nation. He is disciplined by the messenger, and shortly thereafter, toward the beginning of 1964, certainly by the spring of 1964, Malcolm has separated from the nation. He will establish the Organization of African American Unity, He will also establish an organization for Muslims, and he will attempt to develop both simultaneously. He's also very active internationally. He spends about 6 months in 1964 in Africa, in the Middle East, and trying to move forward. It's during this period in time in which we begin to see movement, that is to say, Malcolm begins to move toward orthodoxy, if you will. He brings a whole lot of people with him. Now, there are there's a lot of evidence that there were individuals within the nation, including Wallace Muhammad, who were moving toward orthodoxy, orthodoxy prior to Malcolm's split with Elijah Muhammad. But it is my contention, it's obvious that you have a large group of people who move toward orthodoxy, and I'm using the term orthodoxy. That's a contested term itself. Perhaps we'll have opportunity to talk about it during the question and answer period. But it's obvious that a large number of people will move with Malcolm into orthodoxy. But it's my contention that we have to understand the history of the ways in which Islam develops within the African American community. And it's a convoluted development, and it cannot, in my opinion, be divorced from, you know, the struggles that black people experienced in this country. Now, I've left out a tremendous amount because I don't have any more time, so hopefully we all have opportunity to follow up with some of this in the question and answer. Thank you so much.